This is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. I'm Jennifer Staten. It's 9:08. We're devoting an hour this morning to a special live broadcast about a topic that's gotten a lot of attention for the past few weeks and months, a topic our listeners have been telling us they want to hear much more about. That topic is the recent proposal from the Austin Independent School District to close 12 district schools, send students from those schools to other campuses, upgrade facilities and programs at some schools, and make some changes to attendance boundaries. The topic is actually not new. The district and school board have been talking about this for over a year, but the specific draft plan was released on September 5th. The reaction has been a mix of shock and disappointment from some AISD families, especially those whose schools will be closing. After all, a school can be the center of a community, and closing a school can almost feel like losing a family member. This morning, we'll hear from AISD and from school board trustees to get a better understanding of the plan, the reasons behind the choices, the concerns about them, and what happens next. Just about all of the questions that you'll be hearing this morning are ones that listeners submitted to KUT ahead of time, things that they told us they wanted to hear about this proposal and process. And I will be joined for this hour by KUT's education reporter, Claire McInerney. Good morning, Claire.
Hi, Jen.
And we're going to start off by hearing from the Austin Independent School District about the plan itself. Dr. Lisa Goodnow is Associate Superintendent of Academics and Social and Emotional Learning for AISD, and Matias Segura is the district's Operations Officer. Thank you both for being here with us today.
Thank you for having us.
We're happy to be here.
And we do want to note that we invited Superintendent Dr. Paul Cruz to join us, but he did have a previous commitment today. So, Matias and Lisa, let's start with a basic question. It's a big question, but I'm going to ask you to keep the answer kind of on the small side. What exactly is in the district's proposal?
So I'll start off. So the district undertook this comprehensive plan to really kind of reinvent how we support our students and families. At the end of the day, we want to ensure that all of our resources, limited as they are focused in the classroom. And so we recognize that we need to look at all the different facilities, we need to look at the programs, and we need to look at all the different folks that are teaching within our classrooms to come up with this comprehensive plan. This embodies that body of work, and that's what we're putting out there for input.
And tell us a little bit of the specifics about what's in that plan.
Well, I can let you know that you see, if you go to our website and you can look at all of the different scenarios, but there is definitely a focus on what we can do to improve teaching and learning in every classroom across the entire district with district-wide improvements. We also have specific scenarios that address, again, how we can ensure every child has the best teacher in their classroom, engaging in the very best learning experiences.
So let's talk about the plan lays out potential closure and consolidation of 12 schools, expansion of programs, a lot of reworking. And so I think what a lot of parents want to know right now is what was the criteria that made these 12 schools bubble to the top? We'll start there.
That's a fantastic question. And when we started this process, we made a commitment that no singular data point was going to be the data point that we use to make a decision.
For example, enrollment.
Enrollment, utilization. That's often what we hear as, you know, the data point that that should be used or could be used or has been used. We made a commitment to you know, our community that that wasn't going to be the case, and I believe that this package reflects that. So when you think about the types of information that we have that went into this, we looked at the types of programming that was available within elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools. We looked at performance of principals and teachers. We looked at the facilities. We looked at supporting students and putting them in modernized facilities. So all of these things came together to develop informed scenarios. And along the way, we picked up information from think tanks and community members and really distilled that down into what we believe are scenarios that we can achieve and move us in the right direction.
So for example, we're seeing a lot of the schools that are being proposed for closure are east of 35 or east of Lamar. A lot of them, the majority of them have a majority of low-income students. And so explain why, you know, those schools were chosen compared to other small, old schools that have a different makeup of students.
Well, I think that if you look at you can see that there's a wide array of schools that were addressed. But most importantly, when we made those decisions, we weren't just looking at the vast data set. We were really driven by ensuring that every student had access and opportunity to the very best teaching and learning. And for me, as a teacher and as the person who leads education in this district, facilities matter. But most importantly, what matters is that community and that ability to concentrate resources so I can keep the very best teachers in the classroom with abundant resources.
So some words from the plan itself. Buildings are important, but kids are more important at the center of every proposed change. But what we're hearing is that closing a building impacts the kids, and that this feels like it is more about the buildings and the kids, because schools are closing, and that feels very personal to lots of families. And it's impacting schools on the east side of town.
So one of the things that we often struggle with is this balance, right? We have to figure out the best way to support all of our students across the entire district. And what is currently happening is, in our facilities that are aged, you know, I average about 48 years per campus, we are spending dollars that really should go into the classrooms on buildings. You know, we look at HVAC systems, mechanical systems, plumbing systems. All of these things continue to worsen over time, and it's going to require a substantial investment to support that. Now, long term, our goal would be to move funds from operation and maintenance expenditures into the classroom. And when you think about where we have, you know, classrooms and buildings across the city, that's because of how the city grew. We just have more campuses east of I-35 than we do west. And so it becomes, you know, one of these balancing challenges that we have. And hopefully, you know, this proposal shows that, or these scenarios show that.
So we got a question from a parent named Monique Mehta, who is a parent at Maplewood Elementary, and her question had to do with some of the new programs that you guys have proposed in the plan. And so we're going to play her question, and we'd like you to answer it.
My question is, why are professional pre-college programs like engineering, STEAM, IB, concentrated in resource-rich areas, while vocational programs are nothing slated for resource-poor areas?
So I think one of the things that we need to remember is that this proposal of school changes in 2019 isn't everything we do. As early as 2011, I was working in the high school office, and we had schools that were up for closure then, high schools. We invested tremendously in putting in high-quality, transformational programming, not just getting a school off a bad list, but transforming the experience for our students in LBJ and our new Northeast High School. Early College High School is demonstrating that students at those two schools, but in particularly now we've added five more, where students are earning free college tuition, many associate's degrees, and going on for full scholarships in four-year universities. So the plan doesn't necessarily easily reflect the investments we've already made.
Well, and I think I'd like to follow up on that. I think what I've been hearing a lot from parents is, you look at this proposal, and so we have this group of schools that are being proposed for closure, and then in different parts of town that aren't bearing the brunt of this dramatic change, they're getting, like she said, an IB track, new STEAM or fine arts programs. And so kind of explain, like, the reasoning behind how that was distributed. Why not put the new fine arts at a consolidated school that could happen?
So interestingly, you can see that there are fine arts investments in some of the schools that were
That's
looking
just an example,
at consolidating.
But, you know, any of the new
consolidating,
programming.
But also, again, attending to those rigorous programs that already exist in some of our East Side schools, and really where you could almost see some programming deserts in where we hadn't focused on CTE. So in
career and technical education.
Yeah, sorry, and particularly in the mm-hmm. Southwest. So we did look at the overall map and know that across the district, we also have students who don't have access and opportunity all over the district, not just in certain zip codes.
So, Matthias, you wanted to add?
Yeah, one of the things I'd like to add to that is when you look at, you know, the timeline and recognize this is going to occur over years, you know, we want to allow for time for these communities to come together and tell us, the district, you know, what programming makes the most sense in these communities. You know, so when we think about, you know, what will be, I think it's very important that we need to acknowledge that, you know, we plan to get there and identify what programming makes the most sense with those communities, you know, at the table.
So you're taking input on all aspects of the plan, not just closures? You're taking input on programming on everything?
Absolutely. I can speak to that. Some of the things we've already heard from our Board of Trustees and our community is that we need to attend to academic excellence and rigor across every single school. And so we already are developing a scenario that will demonstrate our focus on strong, rigorous curriculum in every classroom with a well-qualified teacher.
And Matthias, I want to follow up on something you said earlier about looking at growth in different neighborhoods across the city. One question we got from several people has to do with the fact that there is new construction in East Austin. There is apparently population growth, at least ahead in East Austin. Why close schools in a part of the city where it appears that at least down the road, there may be new people, new families moving in?
That's a great question, and we are constantly evaluating all the information we have in front of us. One of the things that we use to make these informed decisions is information we receive from our demographer. And yes, there is a lot of development occurring east of I-35, but unfortunately, that type of development isn't the type of development that draws the types of families that would build up our school capacities.
What do you mean, the types of families?
It's the types of developments. They're higher valued properties. It's not necessarily low income or medium income or available to most of the folks that are in that area. So what we're seeing is folks moving out of those areas, and because they're not living there, their students are not attending our classrooms, our schools.
But I guess we're curious about like the potential for new families. I mean, we're seeing like Mueller growing in that areas where a lot of the closures are being proposed, and that has single family homes.
Absolutely. And so again, we're looking at all the data sets that we have, and based on this plan, we are confident that we can support growth, you know, within the community for years to come.
You are listening to a special live broadcast from KUT Studio 1A about the Austin Independent School District's proposal to close and consolidate some district schools and to realign and expand some programming. Dr. Lisa Goodnow is Associate Superintendent of Academics and Social and Emotional Learning for AISD. Matthias Segura is the district's Operations Officer. Claire McInerney covers education for KUT. Our discussion will continue in a minute. It's 9:20. I'm Jennifer Staten, and this is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. This is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. I'm Jennifer Staten. We're coming up on 9:22. This morning, we're devoting an hour-long live broadcast to the Austin Independent School District's proposal to close and consolidate some schools, realign and expand some programming, and change some attendance boundaries. We're joined by Dr. Lisa Goodnow, Associate Superintendent of Academics and Social and Emotional Learning, and Matthias Segura, Operations Officer for the Austin Independent School District. And with me is KUT's Claire McInerney, who covers education for KUT.
Thank you. So we're going to start right now with another question from a parent. This is Joy Victory, who has a student at Dawson Elementary, and she sent this question in asking about the transition period if this vote goes through.
Yeah, I'm wondering, how will AISD guarantee that shuttered schools don't experience teacher and staff brain drain and student flight in the years before the schools are closed? I'm mostly worried about the impact of the next few years and the school just sort of losing its enthusiasm. It's a great school right now.
I appreciate that question so much, especially because of the part of my title that's around social emotional learning. I think it's important to know that the district is committed to listening to our communities that are affected. It's important to also know that we have an informed listening tool for that. We also have examples currently of schools that have come together as a result of the 2017 bond and are building a new community. It'll be as important, again, to attend to the programming and the training as it is to attend to the feelings of the communities and the teachers and the principals. As we bring people together and let the communities co-create what's next for their children, their teachers, we believe, and we already have some evidence, that the outcome will even be better than what they're currently living in.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people are concerned 4 years or 3 years is a long timeline if you have a third grader, you know, and so people are thinking about transferring, finding other options so they can just, you know, make one switch and not have to keep doing this. I mean, is that something you guys are prepared for at semester or next fall to see this, you know, massive change in how people are choosing schools? Or are you going to invest in like trying to keep people at those schools they're at?
Interestingly, we haven't seen that exodus, right? So again, I think that there's this assumption that...
Do you mean at like Norman Sims, the places that...
Absolutely. Okay. So we haven't seen that. And I think that we sometimes underestimate the reasons that our parents choose our schools. Mm-hmm. The more we listen, the more we engage, and the more we can bring, I think, those communities together, our communities together, to really imagine and reimagine something better. If you ask even a fourth and fifth grader, help us solve this problem, they're going to come up with ideas we hadn't even thought of. So it's being very real, it's being very honest, and it's engaging our communities.
Is there an opportunity to adjust any of these timelines if a community says, we don't want to wait 4 years, that seems like such a long time, if we're going to make a change, let's do it, or is that timeline set in stone?
So the timeline is not set in stone. Certainly, we're trying to refine it and improvement, just like we are, you know, with every aspect within the school changes scenarios. But that being said, you know, there is logic, there is a progression tied to each of these timelines. You know, in some instances, capital injections required to support the receiving of students. So there takes time to design and construct. Yes, money.
Well, and we did get a lot of questions related to that about giving and taking feedback about proposed closures. So we got a couple of questions along the lines of, is this all or nothing? Or in other words, might one school be taken off the closure list and one consolidation change and everything else stands? I mean, how will you all take community feedback, integrate it into the plan, and make changes?
We've already started doing that, so we're currently working on the second version of this proposal, which has already been through quite a few changes. So you'll start seeing scenarios that are refined, that are developed differently. I think that as that new proposal emerges, we will present those revisions to our Board of Trustees, who will in turn give us feedback and guidance on what next steps are.
Can you tell us any changes that are in that second version so far?
Sure. I think one of the things that I mentioned earlier, too, is that we heard so clearly that while programs are amazing, what really, really matters is very strong core curriculum and great teaching for all students. And so those sort of rigorous AP classes or college preparatory classes, how are we seeing that in every classroom and how does that feed down into our elementary schools? And so we're attending to that very common, strong curriculum and instruction that will prepare all of our students for success as opposed to maybe specialized programming. So you'll see more of that in version two.
And what is a tipping point for you all as far as input goes? I mean, how many voices do you need to hear about either a specific closure or consolidation or program before you feel compelled to make a change?
That's a very difficult question to answer.
But I mean, there's got to be an answer because at some point you'll be faced with deciding.
It's not binary. It's not a numeric number. I think what we're trying to do is identify common threads through all the different communities that we are engaging, you know, by way of think tanks with the community series that we've had, what we're going to go through with engagement September 23rd through October 12th. So we have a lot of opportunities for the community to come out and tell us how these scenarios could be improved. You know, what we're going to do is take that in and distill that down and understand, okay, which one of these themes can be executed, which ones improve the scenarios, and which ones do we think are in alignment with the guiding principles that our board voted on back in February, and which ones truly move us in the right direction.
So at the board work session a couple weeks ago, the new equity officer, Dr. Stephanie Holly, mentioned those guiding principles. And for people who don't know, it was kind of this document that the board created saying, here's the criteria we want from these. Let's make sure that every option put in this plan kind of comes back to these ideas and goals. She said that she would have tweaked them if they were here. And so is that something you all have been talking about, like readjusting your goals to make sure it benefits all students?
Well, I think at the end of the day, there might have been some of those like little sub-indicators that fed up to the overall arching guiding principles. And I know that our trustees and our community have made it clear that in improving access, opportunity, and academic excellence for every student is at the forefront. I don't see us shying away from that particular principle. Neither do I see us shying away from the understanding that we have currently have buildings that are in disrepair that make it hard for a teacher to deliver the high quality instruction we're ensuring. We also have under-enrolled schools where the teacher, for example, a music teacher may have to actually go to three different schools. That's managing three different sets of recorders, three different sets of xylophones, three different sets of sheet music, just to deliver the fine arts that we know is so important in Austin ISD. So while we concentrate resources in much more lively and engaging, and I even call them healthy facilities, I don't see us shying away from those guiding principles.
You're listening to a special live broadcast from KUT Studio 1A about the Austin Independent School District's proposal to close and consolidate some district schools and to realign and expand some programming. Dr. Lisa Goodnow is Associate Superintendent of Academics and Social and Emotional Learning for AISD. Matias Segura is the district's operations officer. Claire McInerney covers education for KUT. More questions still to come. Plus, we'll hear from some current members of the district's Board of Trustees to get their reaction to the plan. I'm Jennifer Staten. It's just about 9:30. This is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. This is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. I'm Jennifer Staten. It's 9:34. This morning, we're devoting an hour-long live broadcast to the Austin Independent School District's proposal to close and consolidate some schools, realign and expand some programming, and change some attendance boundaries. We continue with questions from our listeners for Dr. Lisa Goodnow, Associate Superintendent of Academics and Social and Emotional Learning for AISD, and Matias Segura, the district's operations officer, and Claire McInerney is here. She covers education for KUT. Thank you all so much for being here this morning.
Thank you.
So we're going to start this next segment with another question from a community member. His name is Nat Bradford, and he had kids go through Pecan Springs Elementary and lives there right now. And his question has to do with the 2017 bond that voters passed 2 years ago.
We appropriated all this bond money, and then I've spent a massive amount of money at Pecan Springs to renovate it and upgrade it and make it look pretty, and then to shut it down. I'm wondering what kind of stewards of our money is Austin School Board.
So what happens to all that bond money that was allocated to schools if they are closed now?
That's a great question. And so one of the things that we always look at is, you know, this is a continuation to support all of our facilities. And the 2017 bond was certainly a very, very large step in that direction. You know, all of these campuses that we've talked about, there are funds that have been allocated through the 2017 bond program, and all of that was taken into consideration before we brought these scenarios out. One of the things that I think is very, very important to understand is that many of the funds that are tied to these schools are specifically tied to targeted improvements. And when I say targeted improvements, I'm talking about mechanical systems, HVAC systems. There are things that are tangible, but really address making sure that our students are warm, safe, and dry.
So you're going to transfer bond money from a school that would close to the school it goes to?
Well, I think one of the things that's very, very important is that, you know, based on the timeline, you know, if 2 years from now the transition hasn't occurred yet, we're not going to allow students to not be cool. We're not going to allow them not to be dry. So we have to preserve funds to make sure that we can support our students all the way through the transition. And then at that point, you know, we'll use the Citizens Bond Oversight Committee and the board and make a recommendation. And the idea at this point is that those funds would follow the students and then be reinvested back into the receiving campus.
So you're saying even if a school is slated for closure, you'll still invest money in the years leading up to the closure if repairs need to happen? Because that's a question we got a lot from parents.
Absolutely. We cannot. We have to support our students. We absolutely have to support our students. And if there's a drain, there's a roof, there's issues on site, we have to address it. There's just no way we're not going to invest to support our students.
And then is the 2017 bond enough money to do all these renovations at consolidated schools, or would you have to pose another bond?
So that's a great question. And one of the things that we were very mindful of as we went through this process is in 2017, the district underwent a comprehensive facilities master plan.
Where you guys like graded every school, looked at its old it was, what work needed to be done.
We implemented a facility condition assessment, which identified all the tangible components and, you know, the deferred maintenance. And we looked at the educational suitability assessment. How does the building support students? Each of the campuses received a score, and that score kind of laid the framework for a 25-year master plan. The 2017 bond was the first tranche, the first kind of step implementing that plan. When we think about school changes, we had to consider what is right in front of us. We think about the next tranche of schools that we have to modernize. We want to make sure that we pick schools and identify facilities where we'd be able to reduce deferred maintenance, which is a long-term liability, and we'd also be able to move students in a modernized facility. So if you look at Wooten, you look at Palm and Bettes, we're really trying to be proactive and not allow the, you know, this to occur without being mindful of what's right in front of us. So yes, we are looking at, you know, incorporating some of these improvements into future bonds.
So if people don't want schools to close, what if they just vote down a bond? What would you do then?
Well, I think that the my perspective on all of that is that we want to be proactive. We never want to allow and not support our communities to the best of our abilities. And so certainly, you know, that may be a sentiment that's out there, but I think ultimately, you know, we're looking at utilization. The deferred maintenance will continue to rise. Our operation and maintenance expenditures on an annual basis, which directly impacts education, will continue to rise. The utilization of the campus will probably continue to decline. And so when you think about all of these things, we want a proactive plan that we can get behind and really begin to paint our narrative about where the students need to be and not allow it to happen without input.
But failing a bond would leave this plan in limbo?
Not necessarily. I mean, there would still have to be a methodical way of how we introduce it. I think what you would find is some of the improvements might kind of come out of the plan, or we'd have to think about a different way to implement them, but the actual sequence of school changes would probably still have to occur.
And a final question for you all before we move on. We got this question from several listeners. Would this be it? So in other words, 10 years from now, is the district going to say, oh, you know, maybe we miscalculated here or there, we need to do some more school closures? What's the timeline horizon for this, and might there have to be more closures down the road?
So that's a great question, and I would argue that, you know, as an organization that uses taxpayer dollars to support education, we need to constantly, or on a frequent basis, be looking inwardly and making sure that we're using those dollars, you know, for students and for education. So yes, we don't want to have this plan be, you know, only 2 or 3 years out or 5 years out, or be too short-sighted to where in 6 or 7 years we're thinking about this again. But we also recognize that, you know, in 10 years or 5 years, we have to look at it again. We always have to be looking at ourselves and figuring out the best way to support our students.
So there could be more down the road at some point.
Well, I think that I want to note as well, we've been kicking the can down the road a little bit, so we're facing it head on this year. In order to invest deeply in the resource that's the most important in this district, and that is our teachers. There's so many scenarios that in this proposal that highlights an investment in our teachers' ability to be in the classroom, as well as just living and their livelihood, their ability to come together as professionals. And so when we know we can invest in teachers and our outcomes are already great, but go to a much higher level, I believe that our families will continue to choose Austin ISD and that we'll bring more back, even from surrounding districts. I love Round Rock, I love Pflugerville, but I know that we're going to have children choosing Austin ISD.
Dr. Lisa Goodnow is Associate Superintendent of Academics and Social and Emotional Learning for AISD. Matias Segura is the district's Operations Officer. Thank you both for joining us this morning. Coming up, we're going to hear from the current members of the Austin Independent School District Board of Trustees about the proposal. It's 9:41. I'm Jennifer Staten. This is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. This is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. I'm Jennifer Staten. This morning, we are bringing you a special hour-long live broadcast about the Austin Independent School District's plan to close and consolidate some schools, expand programming around the district, and make changes to some attendance boundaries. We've been hearing from district representatives to get their justification for the plan and to get answers to some of your questions. We're going to hear now from some current members of the district's Board of Trustees for their reaction. Geronimo Rodriguez represents District 6 and is president of the board. Arthi Singh is an at-large member of the board. District Operations Director Matias Segura remains with us, as does Lisa Goodnow. We thank you all for joining us this morning. So, Arthi and Geronimo, first of all, I'm interested just to get your reaction to the proposal from the district as you've read through it and started hearing from constituents. What is your reaction to what the district has laid out?
My reaction is that we are, the school changes process is a kind of an umbrella term, you know, and we talk about its effect on people, places, and programs. I feel like the school changes document as it currently is focuses mostly on places. So what I really want to see is more on our programs, not necessarily the thematic programs, which are actually very good. I'm happy to see that in there, but really the basic building blocks that will ensure that we have an equitable education for all of our kids. And I would like to see a little bit more about the staffing. We did approve a huge pay raise for our teachers back in June, so that kind of address some of the equality aspect in that every teacher was getting either a 7% or 6% pay raise, but the equity part of that is not there, paying teachers more for our Title I schools.
Yeah, and I think what I've heard from a lot of parents and community members is this seems to really focus on renovating buildings. And so you brought this up at the board meeting. I want to kind of follow up. Mm-hmm. When you say like building blocks of curriculum, let's talk like what that would mean, because as an at-large member, you think big picture. What would you like to see different in every single school when it comes to instruction?
So happy you asked that. So when I refer to building blocks, I think about, for example, is math taught the same way in Go Valley Elementary, which is an East Austin school serving mostly low-income students, with the same rigor as you would see it taught at, say, Cassis Elementary, which is in West Austin and has largely higher-income students. If there are discrepancies in that, then I want to make sure that we are not lowering expectations for our low-income students, but we are actually flooding that school with resources and teachers to get those kids up to par. The other part is curriculum in terms of the availability of courses.
And Geronimo, we're curious to get your reaction to the plan also.
Sure. I keep thinking, going back to what Arthi was saying, that this community supported a $1 billion bond package for the 72% of the vote. We passed the largest pay raise for our teachers across the board to our folks. So we took care of our people. We invested in our buildings, and now it's time really to talk about equity in our academic programming. We skirted around the issue, but really we got to be frank. There has been a legacy of exclusion in this community. We know that our zip code matters more about healthcare, about the quality of life, and about education. And we know that we're paying the state over $500,000 a year in recapture. All of that is important in the context of this plan, which the school board sent 16 hours around the guiding principles. And we voted for that 801 for this plan to be constructed and brought to us, these proposals. And now it's our responsibility to own it and make sure that we're discerning what we should be doing, the right thing for all of our kids, for all of them to have student outcomes. Because you know what? We should expect good schools in every part of this community.
So something we've been hearing from the district at the beginning of this process, and then now that the plan is out, is this opportunity is a way to fix inequities of the past. For example, a zip code determining what a school looks like. So for you going forward in terms of voting on this, do you also agree that it's not just about, buildings, you'd like to see more academic and, teaching things addressed?
Absolutely. I think when you look at the proposals around expanding the hours from 6 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. and helping working people here.
So that's something right? In the plan that says
one of the
parents can bring kids.
Yeah, one of the school proposal changes. The
like
idea
child care from 6 a.m. to 6:30.
Yeah, and the idea that we're going to create a pre-K to pre-med effort at the LBJ High School, expanding the Gus Garcia Boys Academy for the Gus Garcia Boys School from 6th to 12th grade in social justice issues and legal issues. I think those are important, but there are still outstanding questions, and that is why I really appreciate this forum and the ability to answer questions for the community. And frankly, that's why from a governance perspective, we didn't just say, here are the proposals, we're going to vote on them in the next coming meeting. We're going to wait and hear the community and co-create what we're trying to accomplish for our kids.
There are opportunities. They're going to be meeting starting on Monday. There's already input being taken online, but the timetable for that is about 2 months. We heard from Lisa a little bit earlier that there are already sort of some rolling revisions and rethinking underway. That feels like a very compressed timetable to take input from what I imagine going to be a lot of folks, try to keep revising, and then have something to vote on in November. Is that a realistic timetable?
Well, you have to remember that we're on a journey around transformational changes to ensure that all of our kids have good outcomes. So this is a part of that. Our policy actually allows us to make a vote in December for changes that are going to happen in the next school year. But these are changes that are going to happen over time. I think what we have to realize is that this community where there's suburbanization of the poor, where individuals who are coming into our community are waiting to have less kids. There is a lot of things going on, gentrification, All these things impact the ability for the school district to continue to have schools and not focus on student outcomes, student performance for those that are the least among us.
I want to follow up. So sure. You're saying you can go to December, but you have to vote on all of this at once. Can you clarify
impact of some of these decisions will happen over time. I think what we have to do as a board, ask questions and get clarity for the community, because I think we've gotten emails from a lot of community members. Some are concerned about their particular school. There are some that are incredibly thoughtful and intentional about, well, have you thought about this particular issue? Have you thought about this academic program? And I have to say, one of the most, the ones that have impacted me the most is around the language that we use around Maplewood and Campbell. Mm-hmm. And in being very honest with ourselves that maybe that language wasn't the best way to communicate it and own that, but we're going to move forward and co-create the world we want to, where we have good schools everywhere in our district, and we don't have a mindset of scarcity, but a mindset of abundance about what we want to do in terms of helping our kids graduate high school, college, career, and life ready.
Geronimo Rodriguez represents District 6 and is president of the board. Arthi Singh is an at-large member of the board. Thank you for joining us this morning. It's 9:50. I'm Jennifer Staten. This is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. This is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. I'm Jennifer Staten. It's 9:52. This morning, we've been devoting an hour-long live broadcast to the Austin Independent School District's proposal to close and consolidate some schools, realign and expand some programming, and change some attendance boundaries. To get some reaction and thoughts about how this might impact the entire city of Austin, we're joined by District 1 City Council Member Natasha Harper Madison. Just about all of her district sits east of I-35. And Kazike Prince is Senior Policy and Education Coordinator for Austin Mayor Steve Adler and Chair for East Austin Coalition for Quality Education. We thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
And here the entire morning has been KUT's Claire McInerney. She covers education for KUT. Thank you, Claire.
You're welcome.
So Natasha and Kazike, first of all, from where you all sit, we're interested in your response to the proposal and to what you've heard this morning.
I think my initial reaction is about how is this going to be a tool, and this was referenced earlier, how is this going to be a tool to not just be bold, but to be anti-racist in all that we do? So when we look at every process from who gets the contracts, who is hired, the chief equity officer, Dr. Stephanie Hawley, talked about the cultural competency, the cultural proficiency that's being pushed out across the school district. All these things take time and energy, but if we're not looking at this as a way to be anti-racist, then we're not achieving our goals. And I think that's part of what the school district is trying to do, but I think that's going to be it's a hard, heavy lift, but I think we're moving in the right direction, hopefully.
So unfortunately, the folks listening at home can't see me feverishly nodding my head in agreement, but what he said. And if I may add to that, I'd like to do a couple things. I'm really, really grateful for Geronimo for acknowledging language and acknowledging that words matter and how we describe our scholars, how we describe our educators, and how we describe our schools matters. And so I was actually having a conversation with somebody yesterday, and it gave me a real good opportunity to think about this in a way that was really thoughtful. We were talking about structure and regimen and how important that is to our scholars, how important that is to families. I think for folks who don't have children, they can't really acknowledge and recognize the importance of consistency and structure. And so when we talk about closures, when we talk about consolidation, I think we all have to be very, very mindful about the impact on families. Families for children of all abilities, but most especially families whose children are really, really rattled by any sort of disturbance in their routine. And so I think as long as we are all doing three things. One, acknowledging exactly what Dr. Prince recognized in that we have to be mindful about cultural competence and we have to be mindful about the execution, right? So it's not just you go through cultural competence training. I think we regularly need to revisit whether or not you've established proficiency. And then we also have to be mindful about recognizing difficult opportunities, right? So we keep saying closure and we keep saying consolidation, but I don't think we're really taking the opportunity to acknowledge this is an opportunity in and of itself. And then lastly, I think really, really paying attention to what we've learned from Austin's history as a city and Austin's history in conjunction with Austin Independent School District.
I just want to quickly say in the plan, you guys both referenced this, in case people don't know, there is the district is saying they want to have all staff go through cultural competency training so teachers know how to work with students of different backgrounds, and that's what they're referencing. Mm-hmm.
So, Kazeke, I just want to follow up on one thing that you said about the plan and thinking about intentionally being anti-racist. Is this plan anti-racist? Does this meet the level that you want to see?
I mean, I'm a little bit of a zealot when it comes to making things anti-racist, so there's always room for improvement. So I think the school district's willingness to continue to receive feedback. And also, I want to remind people, this process is very, very different than the conversation we had back in 2011 when all of a sudden schools closed or were being talked about closed, and no conversation about racism, no acknowledgement of the history of institutional racism. And so I think this is at least an attempt to do differently than we did before. This is a conversation we've been having for a while, the hiring of a chief equity officer to be a part of this process. These are all, I think, valid attempts on the school district's part to ensure that anti-racism and other types of institutional systemic bias are being attended to. And I think the challenge is that how far is enough? Because what we're really dealing with is we have some schools that are underserved, but the thing that we don't say is we have some schools that are overserved. And so how do we deal with the reallocation of resources to schools that have been underserved for generations? And that's the complaint many people have. And so it's a struggle, and I know it is. But I think that's the hard work that the school district, but the school district isn't solely responsible for this. This is an investment of the entire community of really trying to make sure our schools are performing well in every part of our community.
Right, and right now the district is, you know, listening and about to host all these meetings to listen to people, and I think that's a wonderful point that this is also about, this plan is about changing the entire school district, and right now a lot of people are worried about my school. And so, you know, talk a little bit about how parents and community members can, what other nuggets of knowledge they should have during this process to think about equity and how all students are being served.
So if I may, as we're talking about anti-racism, something I'd like to really point out is so frequently when we're talking about equity issues and we're talking about anti-racism, there are brown people saying the words. There are brown people making certain that we all acknowledge the importance of anti-racist work. I think if we're going to talk about anti-racism, we also need to talk about comprehensive allyship. Everybody needs to be saying the words, because that means we are actually accomplishing the goal of getting everybody to make it a priority. So I'd like to start with that, but also just sort of moving forward, thinking through equitable distribution of resources, something I really want to make certain to point out, and I don't want to harp on it, but it's a school that's in my district and a school that I've been watching this administrator worked tirelessly and dedicate himself entirely 100% to. So I'm talking specifically about Principal Moore over at Campbell Elementary School. Principal Moore has single-handedly taken a school that is under-enrolled and otherwise probably would have been up for consideration for closure or consolidation, and it is actually up for consideration for consolidation according to the plan, which I want to point out, I'm really appreciative that the plan is fluid and that there's room for growth and improvement. But I think it's been referred to as a consolidation that would offer students coming from Maplewood two options. One, the students in the liberal arts programming to go to Blackshear, which also has a liberal arts program, and then the other students go to L.L. Campbell. I want to be sure that we point out L.L. Campbell is a performing arts school, and that we're not making that delineation between these educational facilities and the hard work being performed by administrators who are so, so dedicated. So I'll just go back to what I said before. Words matter, how we describe things matter, how we describe people and places and our scholars really matters.
Natasha Harper-Madison is District 1 City Council member. Kazeke Prince is a senior policy advisor to Austin Mayor Steve Adler. KUT's Claire McInerney covers education for KUT. This is KUT and KUT HD1 Austin and KUT.org. I'm Jennifer Staten. It's 10 o'clock.